As racism becomes in vogue again, mixed race, biracial, dual nationality holding, half-breed, non-nation, I could go on, but you get the gist. I want to hear the experiences of what it really means to grow up between two countries, two cultures, two religions, two cuisines. Again, you get it. I'm going to invite guests from the world of comedy, academia, law, journalism, TV and sport to chat over their heritage, traditions, culture clashes and experiences of being dual heritage in modern day Britain. What happens when your mother tongue don't match your lingo, or your voice doesn't match your face, or your dad is mistaken as your cab driver, or you're asked if you're your child's nanny? It does start to chip away at your sense of identity when you're asked for the 400th time, but mate, where you from? Welcome to No Nation. Joining me today is the absolutely lovely, lovely, lovely presenter, Radzi, and I'm going to attempt your surname.
Go for it.
It's got more syllables than I've ever seen before. Radzi Chinyanganya?
Ganya. Yeah.
So Radzi Chinyanganya.
Should we go for the full name as well?
Okay.
So it's Munya Radzi Chinyanganya. Or to your point of the whole mother tongue thing, my dad would have said Munya Radzi Chinyanganya, which is not easy to spell when you're 4 years old.
Munya Radzi Chinyanganya.
There you go, smashed it.
Radzi, who you would have seen presenting on Blue Peter, Cannonball, Match of the Day Kickabout. He is literally everywhere. I went to look up what you're doing and there is not a piece of TV, television that doesn't have your beautiful face all over it. So Radzi, you've taught me how to say your full name, which is probably the most poetic thing I've ever heard in my life. It's absolute poetry. But can you tell me a bit about tell me what your background is?
Yeah, so I was born in Oxford to two parents, obviously. My father was from Zimbabwe and my mum is from Scotland, Dundee to be precise. And then I grew up all of my life in England. I spent all of my school holidays in Scotland. I wear a kilt on formal occasions, but like you say, where are you from? To me, it's not the double from, it's pause, head tilt, from. And that means, where's the black parent from? And so I'm actually excited to get into this conversation because it's something that I feel if you're not in the bubble, you wouldn't appreciate it, but I think you might be interested to know what it actually is like, because everyone has it, regardless of your mix, everyone has the same experience.
Yeah, totally. So dad's from Zimbabwe. Weirdly, I was saying to my mum that I was chatting to you and she was like, half Zimbabwean, half Scottish. I was like, how do you know? And she was going, because I was having a conversation the other day about the, because my mother's family are originally Irish and my dad's Middle Eastern. And for some reason there is this, what is it about Irish and Scottish women that seem to marry either African or Asian heritage men? There's just this, there are so many of those mixes. I think there is something that's quite culturally similar, weirdly. I do think there is a thing of kind of like family, community, especially working class women from these Celtic backgrounds and guys from these backgrounds. It's like, oh, that kind of meshes. Did you ever go on holiday in Zimbabwe? Have you gone and spent time there?
Yeah, I've been to Zimbabwe once. And the weird thing is, the tragedy is, when I didn't have money to go to Zimbabwe, I had all the time to go to Zimbabwe. Now I've got the money to go to Zimbabwe, I don't have the time. Right. And now I've got the time, I don't have the capacity because we're in lockdown. And the thing is, it's not a kind of a 3-day trip for me. It's something I want to spend a lot of time meeting a lot of people. And I'm very much the family from Britain. So when I go there, I know you can't not see certain people, you're gonna have to see everybody. And that whole thing of you saying about the family, I guess, the importance of that family pillar, the family structure, that's permeated every aspect of my life, really. Right. And it's the reason I love Scottish people. Because the other thing is about, so in my scenario, if you're like having the white and the black, people want to know about the black side. But actually, I'm flipping proud to have specifically Scottish heritage. So, and that's why, when someone says, where's your family from? That's why I always say, my mum's from Scotland, pause. My dad was from Zimbabwe. Because otherwise, if I say, my dad was from Zimbabwe, the rest is just white noise. Because they're not interested in the next part.
It's the other.
Yeah.
It's the other, it's the bit that's exotic that they want to kind of get to. And also it's how much you relate, because people don't know what your family relationships are like. I mean, I don't know what your family relationships are like, and obviously whatever you're happy to share. But for me personally, I have a lot more connection with my father's side than I do my mother's side, which is probably why I talk about being Lebanese so much. And also because I'm in England and I'm so used to people going, where's your back? Where's your name from? Where's this from? Where's that accent come from? How do you know? So I've talked about that so much. But then the moment I go anywhere and I feel like my English side is being dismissed, I'm like, no, I'm very British and proud. Like, don't dismiss my British side.
Yeah. Well, so in philosophy, they talk a lot about the various eras either coming in reaction to the previous era or coming as an evolution/development of. And I feel that actually a lot of my identity and personality and my outlook on the world is based in reaction to my origin, because my voice doesn't match my face, as you kind of mentioned in the title. I have been told many times before that you sound white, you sound posh. I live in Wolverhampton, but even though I've lived here for 20 years, I don't sound like I'm from Wolverhampton. When I'm in Oxford, people presume that I was from London, or they'd be more concerned with where my family are from than actually the fact that I was born in the John Radcliffe Hospital. When I'm in Scotland, there's never been an issue, but no one has ever come up to me and gone, what part of Glasgow are you from? Because I'm always, if you like, the other. And so as a result, very quickly, and actually maybe not even very quickly, I certainly came to the conclusion that I became very comfortable with who I am. I'm comfortable meeting new people. I'm comfortable being me, whatever that means. And I'm comfortable concluding my own thoughts on things, whether that be over anything from Brexit to religion to drinking to the lot. Yeah.
But can I ask, because that's a really interesting point that you say, I'm comfortable. Was there a transition where you first became aware of this dual heritage and this dual background, and you suddenly became very aware of it, and then you had to go through a period of exploring it before you became very, very comfortable with I'm Radzi? Or have you always had that complete balance of, no, I am myself, I'm my complete self? Because I'm only speaking from personal experience. I went through a real going from one extreme to the other and really exploring what those meant before I got to a point where I was like, no, I'm very comfortable in who I am.
What the kind of the real transformative moment for me in school was, so I went to 7 different schools, but in my last school, I went there for 7 years. So all of my senior school was at one place.
Right.
And it's called the Adams Grammar, as it was called. It's renamed now. I was the poorest kid in that school. I was the only kid that was on what was called EMA, Education Maintenance Allowance.
I remember that.
I was one of the very few who came from a broken home. And as a result, I was excoriated from the cool crew. I was never a part of that. And I remember there were two actual transformational moments that happened. One was, so we were walking to games, and I remember some of the lads had cars, and they drove along in their cars, timed it through a puddle, and just nailed us. It's a tiny moment, but what it was is what it symbolized. Yeah. And what it symbolizes, I've got money,
yeah,
and with that money, I'll do whatever I want to people like you. Now, the reality is, they weren't thinking it in that way, but that's how it was perceived and received from me. So that was one. Two, I remember being in this school, I guess they would have called it a disco or whatever it was, and all my mates were dancing with a girl bar me. And that still was all right. But then what happened was I lit read my mate saying to the girl he was dancing with, why does no one want to dance with Radzi, in a real concerned way, in a real empathetic way. And I was fine with it until I felt like they were pitying me. And then it was, and I then remember on both occasions thinking, I'm not going to do what everyone else does, because in order for me to get where I want to go to, I'm never going to have a handout. I'm never going to have daddy's contacts. It's going to be down to me. And so I remember thinking, F you, F all of you. I remember the lad who drove off was driving a Peugeot 205. And I thought, F you and your 205. I'm going to have a Ferrari, Europa, one for all the rest of it. And so that...
F you with your 205 is the best. It's the best comeback I've ever heard. And I'm even going to use that on my own children. Oh, you're not going to use that FU 205 because that's what you're going to say. So they were very grounding moments for you, very kind of formative.
Yeah. And it was because I felt that from my background, it was like I didn't have a chance. So first of all, I come from a background of pure love, undeniable love, support, belief, all of that.
So who was at home? So that your mum and dad, you said they weren't together anymore.
Yeah, so it was me and my mum and my dad.
And one sister.
Yeah, a younger sister called Rufaro. She's 7 years younger. So me and her, we are very close. I always tried to, I guess I was a bit like a dad to her in some respects, just because there wasn't a dad necessarily here. So I always tried to lead by example and try to protect her and whatever else. So we came from a very unique house in that when my parents were together, there were four people with four different accents. And I thought that was normal. It didn't even cross my mind.
What was the fourth?
Sounding Oxford, my sister sounding Black Country Wolverhampton, my mum Dundonian, my dad Zimbabwe.
That's really incredible. Isn't that incredible? I didn't even think to have a different accent to your sibling. Incredible.
Right. You wouldn't think we look similar, sort of. But my sister's much, much, much lighter than me. And she has bluey green eyes, which I've definitely got over. I'm over it. You know, who would want bluey green eyes as a mixed race kid? Because imagine having all that attention from the girls, Esther.
No one wants dreamy bluey green eyes and tanned olive skin. Nobody wants that, Radzi.
No.
No one wants that kind of pulls of mystery.
They want generic brown melanin filled eyes.
I do kind of get that a little bit. Because
I joined TikTok and there's a filter.
Of course you joined TikTok. I'm still trying to understand TikTok. Carry on, tell me about your TikTok experience.
So there's a filter that you can change your eye colour by wiping your hand across your face. And my mate, one of my best mates, came to me and went, "You really suit green eyes." "No, I don't suit green eyes. My brown eyes are wonderful, thank you very much."
But surely, because you're in your 30s as well, aren't you? Right, yeah. So I think we were probably... when we were probably like 16, 17, do you remember the contact lenses craze?
Oh, yeah.
And girls, boys didn't really do it that much, but girls did it all the time. And they just had these terrifying cat eyes. I remember starting uni and being in a really mixed group of friends and everyone just had these like green eyes and didn't matter what color your hair was, your skin was, we all had these green eyes. And it was just these terrifying mutant cat women all going out on the prowl. It's a bit of a weird trend and probably has done a lot of damage to eyeballs.
You see, I've got a thing about not touching my eyes. So I'd have loved to have tried contact lenses, but I can't. I just can't bring myself to do it.
God, I don't know many guys that did it. But that's all a kind of subconscious thing, isn't it? Of not finding your ethnicity beautiful. And I think that's something that's really ingrained, because I spent all my childhood, I've got very curly Arab hair, and I spent all my childhood straightening and bleaching my hair. And it wasn't till after I got married, I was like, I think I'm okay with my hair. And just the relief of going, oh, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it. I'm fine of having thick eyebrows.
Oh, wow.
Thank God. Because do you remember in the 90s, Jerry Halliwell and those eyebrows? So I used to shave all my eyebrows off and draw these really thin pencils. And my parents were like, "Oh, you look ill." And I was like, "It's the fashion. I hate my eyebrows." That was something of being surrounded by very fair blonde girls. It took a real while to kind of accept your otherness. Was that ever something that you had where you were growing up and you were like, things like fashion aesthetics, those not having the green eyes or hair, was it ever an issue for you?
Yeah, so I when we first moved to Wolverhampton, we were looking for a barber shop, a black barber shop. Mm-hmm. And I won't say the name of this one because it still exists, but I went to one in town with my mum and we walked in there. And I remember it was about nine. And we walked in and I remember it was really noisy and all of a sudden it fell silent. And I remember thinking, oh, that's polite. Maybe when a customer comes in, they stop talking. So I sat down on the bench with my mum. And it was totally silent. And when my mum said to me, "Brad, you stay here. I'm going to go and get your dad to make sure you don't move. You can't leave the shop." I said, "Okay." As soon as my mum left, loud again. And their issue was a white person's coming and possibly a woman's coming, but specifically a white person's coming, because my dad came in, no problem at all, didn't change the noise level whatsoever. And I remember we came back home and my mum didn't say anything to me, but I could tell she was a little bit, I guess it caused reflection, because that was further confirmation that you don't look like your son. You may have birthed this person and yet still you are not a reflection of your son. So then we went to another barbershop, again with my mum randomly. And I went with my dad because my mum had learned her lesson. But one time after school, I went there, my mum came to pick me up and I didn't know where she was. She came into the shop and the guy, so it's called V Cut this time, the guy who ran it was called Village, Denville. And so my mum came in and he said, "Hello, madam, I take you you're looking for your son." She said, "Oh, yeah, that's right." She said, "Can I get you a cup of tea? Can I do that?" No, there's no cups of teas there. You don't have to go into the back, make a brew. And I remember just the warmth.
Yeah.
Now, ever since, I only went to Village to have my hair cut, because if you don't accept my mum, you don't accept me. It's as simple as that. So that was quite an interesting one, where it wasn't as though just being accepted by the black was okay, because it was in what context am I being accepted? If I'm being accepted to the exclusion of my mum, then I'm not being accepted as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But then even in the barbershop, I remember I used to keep my words quite short because everyone was speaking in Patois and I didn't speak in that dialect. So I didn't want them to think that I wasn't black. Mm. That was the thing. And it wasn't until one Jamaican man was in there, is an actually legit Jamaican man, he said, "Your boy," went, "you are... intelligent brethren, intelligent youngster," and he started really just filling me with this idea of I should be speaking more and I should be going to Oxford University and we need more people like you. And I thought, oh wow. And I was about 14, I started speaking more, and then the banter would flow about football. The point being is that going to the barbershop was a developmental thing for me, and then when the cut closed, I didn't go, and hence my hair grew, and that was a whole new thing. Because how's Radzi with an afro now? What's that? What does that mean? What does that say about me? Who am I in this new identity where everyone comes up to me and says, "Let's talk about your hair"?
So your hair is now very much an identity piece. Do you feel like it's become a bit kind of iconic, a bit of an identity?
Yeah,
I definitely can relate to that, because the first thing I started talking about in stand-up was the fact that I've got this really, really thick Arab hair. And because it's been this point of reference my whole life, so that was the first thing I started talking about. And so now it's almost like, well, this is my statement piece. And it's interesting as well when you're talking about your mum, because my daughter is blonde and blue-eyed. I've taken her out and people have just gone, "That is the whitest child I've ever seen." And you're like, yeah, I mean, it's my child though. And they're like, "But Esther, she's so pale and she's so blonde and she's so blue-eyed. She just doesn't look like you." And you, part of you just almost kind of crumbles a little bit. And it's like, I'm struggling to articulate it, but I can imagine how your mum felt when she must have had to get up and leave that, because it's that thing of questioning why you don't look more similar. And it's like, but she's mine, you know, she's mine, but I've had her with another person, so obviously that's two people that are making this child. And for a long time people thought I was her childminder.
The thing is though, it must be painful, because my mum, my first day in school, she came to pick me up and one of the parents said, "When did you adopt him?" And my mum said, "No, he's actually my child." And this person said, no, "I understand he's your child, but when did you adopt him?" And my mum said, "No, I gave birth to him in hospital, I remember it well." And then they said, they smiled, put a patronising hand on my mum's shoulder and said, "Does he not know?" Or words to that effect.
This is like the 1920s. Said, I cannot believe that. It's like something right, from that film with Angelina Jolie, where she's like, "It's not my son." They're like, "It is. You're just too stupid to realise that's your son."
Right, yeah. And so that's... even when I say that, I think... I mean, it's sort of... deeply permeates actually that statement, because you know, you think of your family as reflections of you. Oh, look how much he looks like this, and look at that. Whereas the idea of me, my mum doesn't have that. And even my uncle, my mum's brother, said to me, so when I first got my job on Blue Peter, he watched Blue Peter on, he worked on an oil rig, And he said it was a bit strange because I was sat there watching children's telly, and one of the guys said, what are you watching? Where banter's flowing. What are you watching? Is this to match your own age, you know, your own age range, Tommy? And he said, no, I'm watching my nephew. Now, on screen, there was a white man, a white woman, and then me. To which point, this guy then says, oh, right, I didn't realise you know, he was related to you. And my uncle went, no, it's the other one. Because just the presumption would be, well, of course not a black kid that's going to be related to this Scottish white man on the oil room. And then Tommy said, can you tell the family resemblance? And actually, it's quite a unique thing to being mixed in that scenario, because I guess if you are one race, the reality being, I think if you are a single race, even if that kid isn't yours, the chances are somebody would say, got the same nose as you, same lips as you, same whatever. But when you're mixed, you can just have the he or she looks nothing like you. And that hurts. That actually does hurt.
There is definitely, it's very weird when people don't place you together and you don't get placed in that kind of natural, and it is such a clash of background, so it becomes this thing of like, well, I wouldn't put you with this person, so it all becomes very kind of like, so what are you?
That's what I think makes you. Yes. I think you either push that to the back of your brain and just it is what it is, or it makes you think, well, therefore, who am I?
Yes.
And that
I think that's an important, it makes you your name, actually. I remember because I went through a real phase when I was little of, because I got so badly bullied for being Arab, because I was at school as well, like during the times of like hot shot films where Saddam Hussein, the whole Middle East was just demonized, and it was the Gulf right. War, and it was just like dirty Arab. My school teacher called me a dirty Arab in front of the class. So I just went through it. So I was like, I don't want to be Arab. I hate it. I hate the fact that my dad wears shalabar. I hate the fact that my friends come around for tea and it's like hummus and falafel. And I'm like, why can't we be normal? And then I went completely the other way, and I was like, right, I'm practicing Muslim now, and I'm gonna reject my English side. So it took a long time before I was like, no, I'm Esther and I'm mixed, and I'm very, very proud of being a British Arab. And it makes you your name. It really does. I'm like, no, I'm very much an Esther now, and I know what Esther is, but it took a long time, and not one I would necessarily wish on other people, but it definitely has had its positives.
That, I think, sums it up perfectly, because I think sometimes people talk about getting to a destination and saying, let's take an Olympic gold medal. So you'll say, how was it? Oh, it was amazing. It was unbelievable. But that doesn't mean it's worth the sacrifice.
Right.
It means that it may have been an amazing experience, but as a magnitude, it may not have been as great as the cost that you've paid. Mm-hmm. And so in that scenario if you like, pressure cracks pipes, also makes diamonds. Well, it depends how much pressure is needed and how many pipes are getting cracked to make that one tiny diamond.
Yeah.
And the upshot is, I'm very comfortable with who I am. I want to work in politics long term. That's my kind of my ultimate plan. I am very forthright. I sort of know my own opinion. I'm passionate about certain things that I otherwise wouldn't have been. But is it worth being the other? I'd probably say no. I'd have rather had it easy.
And actually, have you always felt like the other? Have you always felt it doesn't matter, like you said, when you were in that barbershop and you're in a black British environment, or you said most of the guys are speaking Patois, so I'm guessing first generation environment, you're still the other. And then even when you're in a white environment, you're the other. So it's always just being this kind of floating cell of otherness. And people are like, let's just not place him anywhere because we don't really know what to do with Radzi.
yeah, it's so I have always felt like the other. You see, so what TV does is TV makes it almost advocates and encourages the otherness. So what a commissioner's after right now, they want the perception of other.
Yes.
Now a lot of the time it's too much other, because if that other is not relatable, then no one will watch that thing. And it's often people who are the antitheses of the other that are making that supposition. So it's, I have no idea what it's like to be the only insert X or to come from this tiny group. Therefore, I will speak on behalf of all of them and choose the most extreme, and they'll all love it. Well, they won't love it, mate, actually. Hence the reason why your show's tanked. I guess I think TV and any broadcast, any form of entertainment is dangerous for the other. Dangerous to lots of people, but especially for the other, because if you don't know who you are when you arrive in it, I think you will be misshapen when you leave it, because you have to know who is that. Are. A bit like a British person going to America. All of a sudden, I start speaking with this bizarre kind of voice because I'm British now, and everyone. And that's fine. But then you meet another British person, then what are you doing, mate?
Yeah.
And it's then if that's who you are, if you identify as the only, it's dangerous.
You are so right, and that is perfectly articulated, and I'm so happy that you said that, because I think having children has been brilliant for me, and that it does make you very grounded, and you are now a completed person. But I do remember once being told, oh, you get a lot more work, or if we could just see you as a Muslim, so maybe right. If you could just wear a headscarf and you could just be a Muslim. And I was like, and how would on earth would I ever explain that to family members that are religious and also my children? Like, what confusing and quite unsettling messages does that send to people who are looking at me, and as they do, and they say, what religion are you? And I say, well, I don't actually believe in any religion at the moment. I mean, I may change, you never know. But whatever you choose, whatever your path is, you will find it, and we can explore that, and that's fine. But if I suddenly just go, oh no, I pretend to have certain beliefs for money, it's a very problematic message to be sending people that you're in charge of their kind of morality. So exactly as you say, if you come into something with any shaky boundaries, Oh, it could be a very problematic path to follow.
Totally. And it's kind of underpinned a lot of the people I enormously look up to. People I look up to are people who've been unapologetic, people who've pursued something with kind of a relentlessness, people who haven't had it easy, but it all really comes down to kind of an exaggerated reflection of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the first time I experienced racism, and it was a weird one, because I didn't see myself as anything other than white. I didn't even know what the terms meant. But I remember I was 7 and this lad said to me, he went, why are you here, you black? And I actually turned around to the other way, but I thought he must be talking about somebody else behind me, because I'm not black. And then he then said it again. And I thought, he's definitely talking to me. And I remember thinking, that's really weird. And so I got home and I said to my mum, so-and-so said this to me. And then she said, and how did that make you feel? Now that's the response of somebody who's worked in mental health for a long time. And how did that make you feel?
Mum, can't you just go down the road and smash his face in?
Well, ironically, that was genuinely her advice.
Good on her.
The man no longer lives.
So he's dead. And because I've got to say, if it was my boy, I don't think I'd be as calm.
It's an interesting, because actually my mum's whole thing is basically hit them back. And that was actually, funnily enough, against what my dad believes necessarily. Mm. But when you go to 7 different schools and you're not necessarily that big, as soon as someone says anything and you just level them, it doesn't matter. It'd be, we're going to leave that guy because he's a little bit uncouth. But
uncouth. It was, did you go to school in Dickensie in England? He is uncouth. Oh, yeah, there, I've said it. I've put it out there.
But you know what? So I'll tell you about the language though. So I love archaic words. I love them. So what is the weapon which the privileged wield? They wield the weapon of education. And so you can hear from somebody if they've received an elite education. Well, what happens if I usurp that by utilizing the same weaponry that they have with more excellence and more mastery?
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's George Galloway, who left school at 16 years old, whether it's Russell Brand, who didn't kind of really properly attend school, or whether it might be somebody a sort of very privileged member of the royal family who uses the same vernacular, that I love it when I perfectly reflect what I mean when I say it with a kind of concise sentence. But going back to the whole racist thing, is that I didn't realize I was black because my dad was African. My dad was from Zimbabwe, and all of his friends and relatives, they were from this place that I'd never been to, or I'd been to once. I visited, I didn't live there. So I associated Black with African. And so it wasn't until that experience I thought, oh, I don't look like everyone else. I just thought I looked like me, and I thought we all looked the same. But actually, I look like my dad, even though I'm not African.
It completely boggles the mind in that I am so relieved that my kids are growing up in a really mixed area, because my children have never made any reference. And I think back to when I was my daughter's age and how much of an issue it was. You get little triggering moments, like even my dad will like take the kids to school, and I just have these moments of like, or hope her friends don't ever say anything because he's got a strong accent. And then I'm like, oh no, of course they wouldn't, because everyone's from everywhere. And it's, no, there's not, but you have those little sudden flashback moments to the 80s and the 90s. And you're like, oh yeah, no. People aren't quite as flippant in the remarks that they make as they would have been back then. Have you ever felt that you're torn between, or very much caught up in the middle of two identities? Have you ever felt like you're particularly torn between one side and the other, so that you are very much the kind of the chain that links these two worlds together, and now I'm kind of really in the middle of these? I asked this question to Abdullah Afzal, who you might have seen him in Citizen Khan, but when I was talking to him and I said, do you ever feel you're in the middle? And he was like, yeah, cricket. And I was like, oh God, yeah. When Pakistan, you got Pakistan and England. He's like, it's both me, but they're both really important. So have you ever been in that position where it's like, I'm between two worlds here?
Yeah, that's interesting. I went to Nigeria one time with my ex-girlfriend, but she was mixed as well. So her mum was from Nigeria, her dad was from India, but her dad, to add more confusion, was mixed Indian and white. Right. So when we went, so people used to think we were brother and sister a lot when we were together. And when we went to Nigeria, I remember being in her mum's village, and they said people getting on their knees and bowing and saying Oyibo, which means basically white man. But it was white man. But the reason they were getting on their knees was because you didn't see people like us, because you don't get really, certainly in rural Nigeria, you don't get interracial kids, interracial families. So
somebody we were getting on their knees. Strange... Oh, that feels very bizarre.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I'm very left when it comes to politics. It's, no, please stand up. Please don't do this. This is us. We're making, it's making me have all sorts of imagery about, I didn't like it at all. But what that was almost confirming to me again is that, so even in the motherland, I'm being reminded that I'm the other, from the other end of the spectrum. And I'll give you a very specific example of when. So we're in a member of my Zimbabwean family's house. It's a family gathering. And so there's me and my sister and extended members of my family, and says, Rufaro, we go now. I'm probably at this point 15, 16. My sister's probably 9. And I said, how do you mean, sorry, we go now? She says, the kitchen. And I said, do you mean to do the food? She went, yes. I said, I'm sorry, we don't do that. Imagine a room of, if you were to kind of define and describe, if you were just audibly listening, it could sound quite adversarial, because the audio, the amplitude's increasing, and all of a sudden, and all of a sudden, nothing. And then it's, what do you mean? And I said, well, the thing is that if you'd asked me to come, she'd have gone along as well. I said, and if you'd asked both of us, of course we'd have helped out. I said, but it's, you're asking her, unfortunately we don't do that. And they said, no, this is Zimbabwe. And I said, with the greatest of respect, this is actually Bath, England. We're a long way from Zimbabwe. And then she went, no. This is
actually, this is Zimbabwe. Bath, England.
You are genius an idea. It was bloody Bath. What are you talking about, love? This is Zimbabwe. So I state the obvious. Was I provoking Arrestor? Yes, I was a little bit. She's a killer.
This is
so. She then goes. Since this was the next slide, she's something like, no, these we chinaranyas, you must do this. And I said, you see, the thing is that my sister's equal to me, and just because I'm a boy, I'm not really fussed what the culture is, to be honest with you. And I didn't really live that one down. Yeah. And so there was an example of two kind of, if you like, cultures tearing apart. And the thing is, I'd be willing to take one for the team myself, even if I felt uncomfortable. I wouldn't allow that to happen to my sister. And there was another scenario similar where actually having hair like mine isn't necessarily advocated historically, as you can't afford to cut your hair. So you'd be like a homeless person. And so I remember, again, funny enough, same place.
Going back there, though. You can't even remember her name, but you went around her house all the time in Bath, England.
The punishment. So she says, it's different lady. She says, Munyoradzi, when you're going to cut your hair? I said, sorry? Now, I heard what she said, but I didn't have the wit to respond.
A bit of time.
But sorry? She went, when you're going to cut your hair so you can look like your brothers? And I said, well, the thing is, if I had to cut my hair, I'd look like my brothers. Now, brother means cousin. If I cut my hair, I'd look like my brothers. I don't have hair like this because I want to. This is an endorsement deal. And she was apoplectic at my response to that. So it's, but their whole ethos is you blend in, have hair like everyone else.
Yeah.
Almost a uniform. And you don't stand out. And that was kind of, that's a kind of example of when I,
I think that's a really good example, because it's showing how you know the individuality, like you said, your hair has become your thing. It's become like, this is what Radzi is, and then you're kind of being pulled in the other direction of, no, you should want to fit in and be more unified. I had a little bit of that when I used to live in Dubai, and people knew that I was half Lebanese and half English. But all the Arabs that I mixed with would always be like, you're so friendly, but that's because you're half Lebanese. Oh, you're so good at cooking, but that's because you're half Lebanese. Or your hair's so nice, but that's because you're half Lebanese. And I was like, it is getting to a point where you're just insulting my mother. It's like, the only reason I have any good qualities is because I'm half Lebanese. I'm like, she had quite a lot to do with it, and she's all right. So let's just not forget that. And then it's so easy to kind of go down this path of only seeing that part of your identity, and you're like, oh no, I've got these loads of, like you said, you're so proud of being Scottish and wearing the kilt and being very proud of that.
Yeah.
I'm going to finish on one last question, which I'm going to ask all my guests. What is the absolute best thing about having Zimbabwean heritage, and what's the best thing about having Scottish heritage?
I've actually never been asked that question before.
Like, I would say, for example, I absolutely love my hairiness. I love my big eyebrows. I love my big hair. So I'm very grateful to being Lebanese for that. What do I like about my Englishness? I would probably say the politeness that it comes with, and not telling people exactly what you think of them the moment you see them.
Yeah. Wow. You know what? That's actually a really profound thought I've had. Thank you for asking this. So On my dad's side, there are two things. So Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa. And a lot of people say when they go to Zimbabwe, so they had, for example, a national postal service and many things that came from ultimately being colonized by Britain. But within that is a real, search for education. And education in a way of not just having a qualification, but being seen to be sophisticated. And that's something that I've really taken from my dad's side, is the premise of, I guess, using education to not just change what you have, but how you have it, whether that be articulation. My aspiration for oratory excellence comes from my dad, weirdly. So there'd be that side, plus the fact that what my dad's given me is I'm very ectomorphic. So I lose weight very quickly. It takes ages for me to put on size. But point being is I can be lean very quickly. So
it's just to sum up, the Zimbabwe inside has given you a mean metabolism and has given you a epic thirst for knowledge.
Yes, exactly.
What an absolute epic combo. And from your Scottish side, I know you like a kilt.
Yeah, I love a kilt. It's, you know what it is? It's the belligerence. I flipping love it. And it's that it's unapologetic nature. And if you believe it's all in.
Yeah.
All in.
Yeah.
And yeah. So you know what? I'm so pleased you asked that question. I've never thought of that before. And that's actually something I'm going to really think about. That's awesome. Because I kind of think, what is it like to be me? But not specifically, what has the country of origin given me?
Yeah. Like what gifts have they given you? Because I think, you know, these things really add to what we are. So it's best to see the positives and really have a bit of a kind of think about what those positives are and how they contribute, instead of looking at it as I'm constantly having to balance these two worlds. And I think it actually came from when I was having Arabic lessons as a grown woman. And I remember saying to my Arabic teacher, oh, I hate it when I go to Lebanon because my Arabic's so terrible. And they're all like, oh, she can't say this. And my Arabic teacher was like, well, just turn around to them and go, okay, but I have the gift of coming from two amazing countries. You came from just one. And I was like, what a brilliant way to look at it.
Yeah.
I was like, we've been given double whammy.
You know what is really interesting is us being mixed race. And obviously that's kind of where society in the world will increasingly go.
Yes.
I'd be really curious to know 50 years time, when you speak to people, if it will indeed be a thing. Maybe it'll just be what people are. Yeah. And so why are you talking about that? Because that's just normal.
Yeah. Oh, that's a brilliant word, isn't it? Normal. I had that after a gig. Someone came up to me and went, it's so weird that you talk about being Arab, because I always just thought you were normal.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That kind of, it's those kind of lines. You think, I don't know what to do with that information.
No, it's a drive-by. It's a drive-by shooting, because it happens and you're just like, boom, and you're like, you're just there going, I had somebody say, I wasn't expecting you to say you were Arab because I didn't think you could get a semi-attractive one. And I remember going, thank you, as if I had just received a compliment. And then I walked away and I turned to my friend and I was like, semi-attractive. And she was like, yeah, that's the offensive bit, Esther, not the fact that you've just been referred to as one, or that a whole group of people are ugly. You're just obsessed with your narcissistic self going, oh my God, he doesn't think I'm really pretty.
That is classic. Also, it is so weird when it's society hasn't prepared me to deal with this information.
No.
You've given with one hand, taken with another, and nuanced many things, and I don't know what to do with that.
And it's your Britishness where you just go, thank you, and then you just walk away and go, oh, I'm so humiliated. And you just think, where's my Arab side now? If that was, you know, my dad or one of my aunts or one of my cousins, they would have literally just flipped out. But me being super, super, super British, I'm like, thank you for saying that. thank you for taking the time to come over here and tell me that. Radzi, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy life. Hopefully see you soon and enjoy the rest of your incredibly rainy day.
Take care, Esther. Good luck.
Take care, darling. Next time on No Nation, we'll be joined by comedian and writer Jen Brister. No Nation is written and presented by Esther Manito, edited and produced by David Seaward.